Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
Welcome again to our weekly Awaken Call. Today, in conversation with Rhonda McGee, here's how the call works. In a few minutes, our moderator, Preetha Bansal, will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker, Rhonda McGee, and by the top of the hour, we'll roll into a Q&A session and a circle of sharing, where we'll invite all of your reflections and your questions. I've opened up the queue right now, so at any point, you can hit star 6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. You can also email anything to us at ask@servicespace.org. That's the word ask, A-S-K, at servicespace.org. So today's theme, as we discussed earlier, is addressing social and racial justice with compassion. And our guest this week is a law professor and mindfulness teacher with a commitment to formulating mindful strategies rooted in compassion and as a response to social injustice in the world. How have encounters with fear, vulnerability, and anger in the world helped awaken you to new levels of engagement and courageous compassion? And what tools aid in your response? So I've had the incredible pleasure of hearing Rhonda speak and being in circles with her over the past several years, and I can't think of a better person to speak on these issues. And since we have the pleasure of our remarkable moderator, Preetha, today, I'd like to tell you a little about Preetha Bansal, too, and how she's really brought so much wisdom and compassion into the transformation that many lawyers, I think, are going through in this world. So Preetha is an illustrious lawyer with an incredible history of working in the White House and in many other high-level positions in both private and public sectors. And over the past few years, I've had the incredible front row seat to watching Preetha going inward, which is something that has always been there in her career and her life, but on a more consistent, I guess, or more a deeper level, that's the first part of what is happening in Preetha's life now. And so it's amazing to see how much wisdom and so much understanding about how the inner transformation work can impact our government structures, our day-to-day jobs, our everyday in the world lives, from a place of doing the inner transformation work. And so I'm super excited to hear this dialogue today between our moderator, Preetha, who's going to introduce our speaker, Rhonda McGee.
Thanks so much, Sujatha. It's really great to be here. I'm so excited to be in conversation with Rhonda. Rhonda is, I think, a really remarkable person who has uniquely, I would say, been able to combine the simultaneous pursuit of justice from a legal perspective with the deep inner work, not as a kind of seriatim thing. I think some lawyers will go in and out and do the deep inner work, but Rhonda has managed to keep the two in balance as she continues her work in the world. She's a teacher of mindfulness-based stress reduction interventions for lawyers and law students. She is a full professor at the Jesuit University of San Francisco, where she explores the interrelationship between law, philosophy, and notions of justice and humanity. She's an expert in contemplative pedagogy, which is what I love that. I love that a law school is teaching contemplative pedagogy and race law and critical race perspectives. She, you know, her own story, which I'm looking forward to diving into her about. She was born in the segregated South in North Carolina. She had an early interest in racial justice and social justice, and at the same time, she had a deeply cultivated sense of personal prayer, meditation, and inner work. She has been a leader in the mindfulness movement in our country. She serves as the president of the board of the Center for Contemplative Mind and Society, She's a member of the Project for the Integration of Spiritual Law and Politics and so many other organizations. And she contributes and writes and teaches. She's made her home in San Francisco for the last almost 20 years. She's active in several local civic engagements. She's involved with law enforcement and being part of the reform of law enforcement and on mindful relations with the African American community. She's, as I said, she's a remarkable teacher of both law and of inner work, and she's an active practitioner of both. So thank you, Rhonda, for being here. And thank you for your amazing work and service.
Thank you so much, Preeta. I really am just really happy to be on this call and really honored to be in this conversation with you, Sujatha, and the Awaken community, the service-based community in this moment. So thank you so much.
Great. Well, I'd love to just start with, as I mentioned in my intro of you, I really think you're remarkably unique in your ability to, remain active in social, racial, political justice issues from kind of, traditional perches of, let's say, a law school and kind of traditional activism perches with kind of the deep inner work that I know that is part of your life. And I'd love to just hear kind of how that dance between the inner and the outer works for you and how, kind of currently in your day-to-day life right now. And how it came about.
What a great question. So I guess I might start with a little bit of how it came about. As you mentioned, Preeta, in your opening sort of introduction of my work, I grew up in the South, in the United, in the Southern United States. Was born in 1967, so born in at a time when we were still in the throes of what we call here the sort of civil rights movement, and yet we had only just begun some of the deep efforts to restructure our society in the direction of more freedom and opportunity for people like me. And so born in the particular location where I was, it was a segregated society still, quite explicitly in many ways. I was in the black part of our little southern town. And there were many sort of economic and social disadvantages that came with that, but there were also some social and community advantages that came with that. And one of those was that I was surrounded by people who had developed by dint of our life circumstances a certain kind of resilience, a certain kind of capacity to ground themselves and our community in inner resources that would support us dealing with a complicated and sort of disrespecting world in many ways. My grandmother had been called to the ministry, actually. So as a very little girl, I spent a lot of time at my grandmother's home and had a chance to see her ground herself every day in her own inner contemplative practice. Hers was Christian-based, but it was a kind of a model for me of how one might have a deep and devotional commitment to practice, a discipline of practice that would be a support for doing difficult work in the world. She cleaned houses for other people, so she did not have a glamorous job, but she was able to do it from a place, I think, of a sense of her own wholeness and value because of her own contemplative and, for her, religious commitments. And so fast forward to me today, I think the practices that I engage in now are heavily steeped in Eastern meditation and traditions of study, primarily Buddhist. I am a deep student of Buddhism, and so my practice every day is a kind of a sitting meditation practice, and accompanied by study, and then I'm involved in a range, I guess, of different sanghas, but primarily one Sangha here in the Bay Area that is comprised of other lawyers. So for me, the question is, the challenge, if you will, is about making the time to practice on a regular basis, to do sitting practice. But that's not the only way I practice, of course. All kinds of ways of bringing meditative experience into my life including yoga, including walking meditation, journaling. And the challenge, it really is to make the time every day for some kind of, engagement with the practice. And that's what I'm about right now.
That's awesome. So you talked about growing up in the segregated South and in the middle of kind of the burgeoning civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And I know you and I have spoken earlier that kind of spurred you, inspired you to pursue mm-hmm. law as a method of social justice. Mm-hmm. And law is so much focused on kind of external structures. How do we shift the world to provide opportunities and, create spaces for people to function in certain ways that the rules drive them to function. And I guess I wonder, how did, in the midst of that focus on racial justice, social justice, making the world a better place through moving the external structures, how did your turn to mindfulness and the inner work come about?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think I have always seen the work of racial justice and social justice through a kind of spiritual lens. I mean, I've always seen these issues of discrimination and othering and oppression based on these social and cultural identity markers through that lens of what it means in spiritual life and in the light of kind of a deep commitment to awareness of who we are that goes beyond our social identities. So for me, and again, maybe because of the way that I was raised to have this kind of orientation to the beyond the material, right, to our common humanity that goes well beyond these categories. When I came to law, I was, of course, like we all are in law school, kind of indoctrinated in this worldview that is heavily rights-based, heavily individualistic focus, right? So what I would call hyper-individualism, which emerged as a response, a positive in many ways response to feudalism, to this notion that we didn't have individual rights, but had evolved in the 20th and 21st century, certainly, into what is a kind of hyper-atomized and very individualized notion of what it means to be a human being, and this idea that without the kind of protection of these legal rights, we have no way of connecting with each other, and the sense that we're heavily vulnerable without these rights. Now, there is some truth to that, but I think there are ways that I felt legal education maybe over-inscribed this notion of individualism and set us up for a sense of alienation, not only from ourselves and our deeper being beyond that which we can reduce to a resume or that which we can fit into a claim or a cause of action in law, but there was an alienation from each other as well and from, the planet, the sort of the non-material world in which we're embedded. And so I was just aware of that going into law. And so for me, there was always a little bit of a kind of a quest to kind of find a way to bring that sensibility in. And so I was looking for ways throughout my career, I think, to do that and ultimately, found some ways to do that. Through a community that included Sujatha and now includes you, Preeta. But really, it's been a long journey. It was, 20-some years ago now that I graduated law school, But I would say, and I practiced for 4 or 5 years before going into law teaching, but the entire time that I was teaching law, I was trying to figure out ways of doing this. And finally, after getting tenure, 7 or so years into my law teaching, I really was almost at a crisis point, feeling like if I couldn't bring more of the inner dimension into law teaching, into my sense of what it meant to practice more effectively, to be a peacemaker as a lawyer, then maybe I should be on another path. So it was through this a little bit of a dark night moment where I was really exploring, can I bring this into law? And if so, how? I found a good counselor who had her own sort of spiritual psychology base and set of trainings. And she basically encouraged me to first explore whether or not I could deepen my insights and community of support in law and explore bringing this inner dimension more to the fore. And if I couldn't, I could always leave, but I could at least try it. And so here we are after 13 or so years in that experiment.
That's remarkable. You know, it's interesting. I'm very struck also by having been most of my life a constitutional lawyer, very struck by the notion that, you know, as you say, so much of law is rights-based. It's about mm-hmm. what am I entitled to from the system and from society. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the work of inner transformation, the inner work is so much about, you know, what are my duties, or I don't even want to say duties, but what is my joy in giving to others, and mm-hmm. how can I be my brother's keeper, my sister's keeper? How can I look out for the other as if they are an extension of myself? And yeah. I'm wondering, as you work particularly in the area of race law, and mm-hmm. With whether they're African American students or majority mm-hmm. race mm-hmm. students, how do they respond? You know, they come to law school also to advance rights, civil rights, social mm-hmm. justice rights. How do they respond to this talk of duties and obligations and giving rather than receiving?
That's a really good question. Well, I would say that, you know, part of it is, you know, they see me as being engaged in a broader project. So I teach classes that deal with race in American law. I teach torts, which is about personal injury law and the different ways we respond to it. I teach a course called contemplative lawyering, which is about developing a legal professional identity that does embed this inner approach. So I think part of it is they see the work that I do in race as part of a broader project that is about bringing this different dimension into law generally. And frankly, I think there's a percentage of our students who have these similar insights, or at least, you know, are hungry for something. They may not know how to name it, but they, a percentage anyway, comes into law school, you know, interested certainly in the formal system for how we have sought to resolve these challenges, but aware that that formal system leaves a lot to be desired, hasn't worked so well over the years, and doesn't really seem to be meeting our deep human needs for healing and connection around these issues. So on the one hand, it is a challenge when we're sitting in those classes actually looking at legal precedent and thinking about them together. And of course, they take my classes, but they're taking other classes that are much more traditionally framed. It is something of a challenge to help keep my students, I guess, in a way, encouraged that they can be agents of change in this way, that they can themselves think a little bit differently than the precedent has done about these issues, bring this different dimension in some way over time, perhaps, not in a facile way. It won't be easy. But so it's about kind of encouraging them to see themselves in this long tradition of lawyers as change agents, and to offer this perspective as support for kind of reconceptualizing law and the processes by which we make law. And it's challenging on the one hand, but it's also, I think, for many students, like a breath of fresh air, a cold drink of water when they've needed one. It's kind of a place where the sort of cognitive and emotional dissonance that they have been feeling in law, right? They've been in those classes and they've been feeling like, all right, I'm learning this strategy. I'm learning these precedents. I'm learning these rules. And yet inside they see that these strategies, precedents, and rules have not changed the world. And they know that we need something more. And so it's sort of being the person on faculty who can say to them, yes, that sense, that nagging sense that we need something more, I for one agree with you. And how might we together create, you know, a kind of intellectual conversation here in our law school that would create space for thinking, rethinking the law and the processes by which we resolve conflict that might somehow allow for this kind of inner dimension. And so that's, you know, it is a challenge, but that's how I approach it.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think of students, law students probably coming eager to do civil rights work, feeling like in some ways the world has not been entirely just in their own personal experiences as well, feeling like they want to make a difference in that, they want to change the world. And, you know, it's interesting, it's interesting for them to hear or to be exposed in that context. Someone like you telling them, yes, we need to change the rules of the world, but maybe we also need to change our hearts and learn to love and learn to be compassionate. And I can imagine a law student at that age saying, oh, I'm supposed to, you know, I'm supposed to shift my view about injustice and I'm supposed to somehow love these people.
Well, like I said, so some do. Some don't quite get it. But there are some who know that justice is part and parcel of love. Like there is a dimension of you know, if we're going to shift from injustice to justice, in some way, compassion has to be a part of that. In some way, opening our hearts to and not only our minds and our systems, but our hearts and our communities to each other, it has to be a part of that. So yeah, it is. First of all, there's a bit of it that's okay, meeting those students who already have this orientation, and then there's a bit that's about expanding the circle of people who kind of would be interested in this. And those are the people who don't quite get it, who do come in, as you suggest, Preeta, with that orientation toward learning the system as it is and mastering that system. And for those, you know, a lot of, I find, having done this kind of work for many years, I mean, you sort of turn back to the master teachers of human history for guidance, right? So, you know, the teachers from Gandhi to, before, obviously, the Buddha, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Thich Nhat Hanh today, who talk about and embody teachings which meet people where they are, right? Which, you know, really engage both the intellectual mind, right, which, you know, takes the system and really in some ways challenges the system on its terms in the quest for justice, but doesn't and has never left the heart behind. I see Jesus Christ in this model as well. This sort of bringing, you know, a heartful kind of engagement with the suffering that is happening under the current system and saying, you know, this is a system you've created. This is the suffering that is happening under that system. And the system itself is a part of that problem. You know, so I've always, since I first did my job talk at the University of San Francisco, which is the only school that I've worked at permanently and full time, I've, you know, got my tenure there and spent my whole career there. You know, when I went originally and did my original talk, it was on this topic and it was on the kind of Janus-faced nature of law when it comes to this quest for justice around inequality, social inequality. That is, that it has been at the same time the source of injustice for many, many subpopulations and communities over time and the hope. And we get nowhere if we don't see the law through that lens. We certainly can't help our students effectively combat injustice without seeing the ever-present need to critically evaluate the system itself. And so I think for those students who don't really come in drawn to a compassionate, sort of love-based, service-based approach to it. If when you speak to them about the inherent contradictions of the system, you know, and the need to have a ongoing critical lens being brought to bear on the system itself, then they, you know, then the question of, well, what does that critique look like? And what are the dimensions of that critique? That's a way that I sort of engage those students in a conversation about the dimension of the criticism that recognizes the alienating implications of what we're living with right now. That is that there is a part of this approach, this hard-nosed litigation and rules-based, rights-based approach to justice that itself is part of the problem. And, you know, so helping them to see that, I don't necessarily start with the terms of love and compassion, but, you know, if in the conversation we are able to bring in, you know, Martin Luther King's notion of justice as love correcting that which stands against love, or Cornel West to speak of a kind of a philosopher, a contemporary kind of racial justice advocate who speaks about, you know, justice being what love looks like in public. You know, we bring those dimensions in as a way of helping students think about, well, if something's wrong with the current system, what is it? And might it be, at least in part, not completely, because there are ways that, you know, we need to reframe legal strategy, legal rules, burdens of proof, you know, different ways we think about evidence, who's permitted to be on the jury. Like, there are specific projects we need to do in law. But if we can see that at least some dimension of the project have to do with re-ensouling the entire system, re-inspiriting what it means to be a human being, like reconceptualizing the legal subject and object of law in a way that is through and through much more holistic and much more in a way infused with this deeper knowing that comes from a spiritual lens. And so that is a conversation that we sort of work our way towards. And again, not every student gets it, number one. Number two, people have resistance to it once they feel like, well, wait a minute, this has got to be a secular engagement, right? Legal education has to be thoroughly secular. Are you talking about something that's about religion? You know, because I'm defended against that. Or are you, in some ways, maybe criticizing, if I do have some orientation that would make a connection between religion and law, are you suggesting a particular religion that I don't subscribe to, something that threatens, say, my deep Christian principles? So the more we get into it, the more messy and sticky the conversation can be. But I think that's what we change agents are about, right? Moving ever more gently and with our own compassion for ourselves and for those of us in the work together, right, into the hard places. And that's sort of what I kind of, you know, find myself doing with my students.
That's beautiful. I'm struck by a phrase you used about ensouling the system, our system of justice. And I think about that in contrast to the notion of embodying love and compassion. And it goes to kind of a question that's been, you know, very much alive for me, having spent so much time in the system. Does mindfulness or several of these kind of inner techniques, do they help to just support the system by bringing around the edges an ensoulment, or should we be working outside of it with love and compassion and, you know, and try and then embody that in the world? So I guess the question is, you know, I've heard it said that, you know, mindfulness is to meditation what empathy is to compassion, that they're kind of light versions of the deeper inner work that's required for really paradigmatic and true transformation. And I wonder how you feel about that kind of, you know, embedding yourself within, you know, an institution and a profession that's very much focused on the system as it is, versus mm-hmm. being outside of it?
Yeah, ongoing question. So I can have an answer for that today and probably another one tomorrow and another one 5 years from now. Because that has been the animating ongoing question in a certain sense for me since that day or that moment where I decided, yes, I'm going to stay here and do what I can. It's as against, the call to perhaps really abandon this system and maybe start some new, or to, if not abandon it, just realize it's going to have its limitations. There's not that much we can do, but I can work on myself, and we can work on our, sort of resources for building communities that can be resilient, notwithstanding these systems outside of it, or maybe in parallel to whatever work we might be doing, the system itself. Well, one thing is, I think from this sort of spiritual view, for me, the challenge is to hold complexity more effectively and to resist false dichotomies and dualities, right? So for me, while I kind of understand this idea that mindfulness is one thing and meditation is another and empathy is one thing and compassion is another, I think we can sort of put too much into the sort of cognitive and intellectual distinctions. And I say that with respect to the fact that, yeah, there are differences, and that, to be engaged in the world is to be engaged in making distinctions and in, sort of having sound starting points for discussion that do evaluate terms and all of that. So I recognize the importance of it. But at the same time, I think we can, first of all, over-invest language with capacity to capture what is worthy of being brought into conversation. And so, for example, mindfulness means many, many different things, actually. There is a very sort of light version of it, and then there are much deeper versions of it that are every bit what others might call meditation. Similarly, I think when we think about empathy, I was actually just this past week on a panel on cultivating empathy at the annual conference of the American Association of Law Schools, which is, this national gathering of thousands of law professors where we get together and talk about law with judges and all of that. And the panel's focus on cultivating empathy was grounded in awareness of the really difficult task it is to actually be in a space of empathy. So, and yes, compassion is an even more challenging step, but I think they're two sides of the same, very difficult, I think, and, lifelong, I feel, spiritual challenge and deepening, call to deepen. Right, how well we can sit in empathy and how effectively we can act with compassion in response to that. So I think, part of it is being much more capacious in our willingness and our ability to sit with these challenges. What is it that we really are seeking when we seek to bring mindfulness into engagement with our legal system? And I say we, each person who's involved in this is going to hold that question differently. For me, I really am interested in transforming our system. I personally am not interested very much. I say this, and yet I do these things that I'm going to say I'm not that interested in. But right. So on the one hand, many people who are engaged in mindfulness and law are, trying to relieve the stress of lawyers. And I've done some of that. I've done retreats for lawyers, which are billed as, stress reduction retreats. Right. And yet that's actually not why I'm there. In fact, I just had this conversation at the conference at AALS. Again, it's a law professors conference. But in that space, we've created a mindfulness affinity group, part of a subsection on holistic approaches to law and law practice. And we were having dinner in that group, and we're going around the table talking about our work to bring mindfulness into law. And I was the one to say, if if I wasn't interested in transforming the system and in deep engagement with social injustice with mindfulness and compassion, I wouldn't be here. Like, this for me is not just about stress reduction, and it's not just about helping lawyers more effectively deal with a really messed up system. Those things are kind of almost inevitably a part of the work. And so part of my own practice has been to kind of be patient, you know, with meeting the system where it is, meeting the needs of the members and participants in the system where they are. If people are needing relief from the day-to-day stresses of the system, I'm there in some measure to provide that. And yet, if I didn't have this bigger view, this view of radical interconnectedness, this view of the deep need, I mean, I feel it's a life ethical call at this moment for us to really live what we can see about our inherent interconnectedness. You know, the challenges that are showing up in global warming and climate change, all of the political challenges that we see today, the wars, these crises that we're dealing with, and that we sometimes, you know, turn to law, whether domestic or international, to help us with, they are crying out, I think, for a kind of a deep sort of almost meditative retreat-like engagement with the question of who we are as human beings, as, you know, sort of so-called individual human beings, always, of course, embedded in community and interconnected with everything. But who we are and what we're about when we try to, quote-unquote, resolve these issues deep from the, you know, moving from what we, you know, the God bless all of those in the Enlightenment era who gave us this notion of individual rights and, you know, the Declaration of Independence and the rights of humanity. Of course, it was man at the time. We, you know, those things got us sort of here. I think the challenge for today is to kind of see, I feel, the need for that system to be brought into a kind of another period of enlightenment, another period of change and transformation that sort of can hold the space for subjective first-person ways of knowing, right? Not only third-person objective, what do the treatises say, what have the judges said, but what is a human being and the human experience telling us about what justice is calling for? What does my sense of myself as being embedded in a world which is alive and through, not just with human interests, but with the non-human world and the spiritual world and the, you know, the environment? What is a deep engagement with our embeddedness and all of that suggest for what the law should be? I feel that is, you know, that's a huge call. I will say that my colleagues at this AALS conference that I mentioned, this American Association Law School conference, they are generally not asking that level of the question. They are not, you know, they see that as probably a little bit of a, you know, maybe a bridge too far still for most lawyers to think that broadly. But it's definitely what I'm about. And so I have to have some patience, right, with my entire field, right, which I know is not quite ready to re-envision the entire system. I know this, but I feel that I couldn't be in the system if I didn't at least keep my vision clear. And then, you know, the challenge for me is to find ways to be in real conversation that translates my vision or sort of moves from where I see where we might go to, well, where we are right now, what kind of language my students need to be competent in, what kind of strategies they need to be competent in to deal with the system as it is, but not to be defeated by the system as it is, and to continue to be inspired and themselves sort of inspirited by a vision that is bigger and more capacious than they're given by the current law and policies.
Well, if you go back a little bit to your roots, you talked about, you know, growing up in North Carolina, the segregated South, being drawn to civil rights and the legal struggles. Where do you see yourself now? Do you see yourself? I think I've often said, you know, when I talk about this, like, where did the real change come about? Was it Thurgood Marshall? Was it Martin Luther King Jr.? Or was it Rosa Parks? Was it the lawyer? Was it, you know, the religious leader, the faith, spiritual leader, or was it the kind of ordinary person acting with integrity and dignity? And obviously, it's all three of the above. I'm not saying it's one or the other, but it's in which realms we choose to operate. Do you see yourself now, in terms of your own self-image, as an agent of social political change, principally, or as someone who's devoted to personal and spiritual change? And I guess obviously we're all of these, but I guess I'm asking, what do you see at this moment as your principal focus, and with the understanding that other things may flow from that?
Right. So that's a really beautiful question that I'm pausing with just a little to take it in. I personally believe that nothing is accomplished without personal commitment, and that includes any kind of change one might want to see in the world. So I certainly see myself as on a path that's about personal transformation and deepening commitment to that. And that is itself really challenging, right? You know, having grown up in embedded in a world, right? I wasn't like most of us, I guess, born in a monastery or born somehow separated out from a social context. And the particular social context that I was born in, was one where there was a lot of poverty, a lot of, the kind of social dysfunction that travel often with poverty, lack of opportunity. So, often communities like that turn inward on themselves. And that certainly was something I saw up close and lived with as well. A family where there was abuse in the household and alcoholism and just all sorts of really difficult dysfunctions that I think, are about personal failings and are kind of wholly predictable consequences of systemic injustice. So, for me, I see myself very much as being on a path that is about personal transformation, and perhaps in some ways I've always seen myself in that, So even from like the position of the playpen in that community, that little small home where all this chaos was actually happening, some almost 50 years ago now, in North Carolina, I was, as a small child, I had a sense somehow that there was a much, much deeper kind of way of being, a something else. I always had a sense of the something more that I associate with spirituality and a spiritual view. So even as a child growing up in that situation, I sort of didn't feel that my horizons were limited by that. But I always sort of had a sense that if that were to be true in the world, I would have to have my own personal commitment to transformation. It wouldn't just manifest. So, deepening my own personal practice is my first priority, and living my commitments. And that is not easy when I am every day, working at a traditional law school in this profession of law, in 2017 San Francisco, right, with a partner who has a love and life partner who has his own kind of, commitments in the world and professional work and social work and all of that, family connections and commitments. So living with integrity, what I see is an ongoing challenge. Like living with integrity, what arises from my contemplative and personal practice commitments is an ongoing challenge. But I think for me, there is certainly a link, and I know you were alluding to it, Preeta, that these things are connected. For me, once you see the interconnectedness of all things and all beings and just have this view of sort of the centrality of the spirit in all things, then there is an ethical call almost, like how are you going to live call that inevitably turns me anyway toward these efforts for social justice and change. And so the one particular area that I've worked around, it has been around racial injustice and helping turn toward the difficulty of naming that and working with that in the world. But I do see it as sort of my personal practice path, if you will, to work on my own self, on my own capacity for freeing empowerment and sort of seeing myself rightly in ways that honor my own experience, which has been about racially embodied existence in a world where race has mattered very much, and a gendered existence in a world where gender has mattered very much, and a class position that is straddled from poverty to now wealth in many ways. So living right on the dot of the embodied experience that is real for, you know, in a certain way. But and that particular path, and I think we're all given a particular path that informs the kinds of ethical work, social justice work that we might each be called to as we deeply transform ourselves through our personal work. So I hope, does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's a beautiful, very thoughtful answer. I think we're coming up. I really want to bring Sujatha into this conversation in a minute. Mm-hmm. I have, and I know there's others that our listeners as well. We can have a deeper conversation all around. But before we do that, I have one last question. And I guess, you know, you talked about your grandmother and watching her in prayer and meditation every day, and how that was kind of an undercurrent, even as you kind of pursued the interest in systemic reform. And I wonder, you know, as you did the turn to mindfulness and kind of became a student of Buddhism, did you have any reconciliation that needed to happen between kind of your Christian origins and kind of some mm-hmm. of the Buddhist techniques and tools that you have adopted?
Yes, that's a great question. I have always, critically engaged, if I can say that, with respect and love with Christianity. And so, you know, seeing the teachings of Christ as one thing and seeing the kind of cultural adaptations of those teachings into something we call Christianity that looks like this in one place, looks like that in another. My quest, and it's actually quite true as well with the teachings of the Buddha and trying to live those live and follow those teachings. You know, it's a very individual path, and I've always sort of been drawn to a way of holding these traditions in that way. It's not that I don't respect, obviously, that religious communities have much to offer. But I do believe that there is much more to be gained by interreligious insight, by looking for the common ground between these deep traditions. I've somehow always believed that there are just core dimensions of this work that resist delineation in sectarian terms, in separate religious terms. And so I know that that is anathema to some people, and some people find that really challenging. I just never really have. And so while I have to say many in my family hold this very differently, and I think my grandmother herself would say, well, no, this is the path. And, you know, for me, the teachings of Christ that were so much about being with society's cast off, you know, spending time with the disinherited, the discarded, and bringing a kind of a compassionate love to bear on that work. That felt to me like you know, when I think about the Buddha's teachings, which were more about, it seemed, you know, getting the mind clear, sort of noticing the way, the kind of traditional ways we cause our own suffering. And then sort of, you know, so to me, there's a beautiful conversation between the original teachings of the Buddha and the original teachings of Christ that mm-hmm. if we don't bring the two together, we're missing a lot. And so I've had my own kind of personal way of reconciling those that I don't know that any of the whole groups of others would share, but it totally works for me. To see the heartfulness and the lovingness of Christ who would be with the whores and with the people who were, you know, challenged. And also to see the Buddha's example and teachings that were about constantly not being fooled about how hard it is to be clear, how hard it is to stay in a place of awareness, and the ongoing nature of the human challenge of not being caught up in ignorance and in attachment, in you know, aversion, right? The three poisons and all of that. So I think there is just a deep call again right now for really finding the next level of enlightenment lessons that can reach ever broadening circles of humanity. And I'm up for that. So yeah,
wonderful.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm about.
We're so glad you're up for that. So I am going to take the host's prerogative to ask the next question. And I do want to remind folks, if you press *6, you will be placed in the queue for question and answers. So it's *6 places you in the queue for Q&A. And then you'll be prompted on when it is to speak. So it was just such a joy listening to the two of you, both of whom I think just have such an amazing capacity to fully engage both your hearts and your minds in this very, this beautiful and necessary conversation. Ron, I wanted to ask you a little bit to talk about something that I know you've done a lot of incredibly deep thinking in, both in your work around what you call color insight, and this sort of deep meditative approach to some of these things that are the hardest things in our society, the things that really divide us. And I appreciated your discussion of the patience that is required amongst attorneys when we're talking about bringing mindfulness to the law, right? And and how people want to be expeditious and use it as a tool, in a sense, to be better at their jobs or whatever. And I think that you've probably shared my experience that that's also a certain level of patience is required among social justice activists.
Absolutely.
And then there's, I don't mean to externalize this, it's definitely true for me personally, that I need to have patience with these parts of myself, right? And I think that the one that I have the most trouble with is something we've talked about with both our spiritual selves and with others, but we see it in others, where spiritual folks who want to do sort of what we call the spiritual bypass around some of these hardest things, right? But I think we are all one, it's all of this, right? And so... And the tendency towards that, and I think a legitimate critique when we're talking about, when we jump really quickly to things like forgiveness and compassion without really excavating the horrors that we suffer that are requiring us to dig deeper, having the deeper experience of those things. So I know that was a really compound question, but I think I wanted to say all that as a way to sort of set the stage for you talking a little bit about what that deep meditative approach is to these hardest things, and that we not do the spiritual bypass, and then a little bit about sort of what is this color insight work that you've asked us to engage in, and what does that look like, and how do we avoid that spiritual bypass?
Yeah. Thank you so much, Sujata. And by the way, it's such a joy to hear both your voices. And to kind of, you know, sense into the communion that is, I think that arises in this work. So to look more deeply at this question of bringing these insights and practices to bear on issues of racial injustice, and to kind of examine what it takes and what I mean by the development of color insight. So I guess, as I alluded to before, I really have seen in my own life, when I said before that I think everybody's particular human life is sort of a gift, I don't mean this in a Pollyanna sense. I know there's a lot of suffering in the world that we each have experienced, and some more than others. And I don't mean to sort of suggest a utilitarian kind of light or lightness about any of that as a kind of a facile way to serve, that you just take your suffering and just turn it around as a gift. And yet, I actually do think that the particular path we've each been fortunate to survive, otherwise we wouldn't be on this call, whatever its journeys, whatever its privileges and benefits for each of us, has been perfectly, suited to teach and to be a source of teaching for others. And so, the way I have been thrown into a world, again, in a segregated American southern town, with all of this chaos that I mentioned, in a body that was racialized by others as Black. I mean, I didn't come into the world as a tiny infant thinking of myself as a Black woman and gendered as a woman, right? But those are the terms, right, of the passage in this social setting. And so I'm aware of that. I can at the same time be aware of the fact that that's not all of who I am, and that these are concepts that don't fully capture who I am. But it would be foolish in this context for me not to be aware of the way in which my particular embodiment is read in this culture through lenses of race and gender and class and education and all of these things. I know this is happening in the world that I live in. And I know that I'm an agent of that as well, that I too, almost inevitably in the social world and processing and recognizing people's social identities and inquiring in some way explicitly or implicitly about what that means and how they came to their views. So I think that deep awareness and engagement with reality, right, again, to the degree we're not living in a small hut somewhere, totally disconnected, or in a forest, right? Mm-hmm. If we are in the world, and in these different, for me, this urban setting or the rural settings of the larger United States, if I'm in the United States of America today, for me not to be aware that race and gender are issues that will meet me whether I want to engage them or not, they will meet me. Mm-hmm. I must be aware of that, right? I mean, I'm just, and so when I endeavor to engage others around these issues, I recognize that their particular packaging and embodiment is going to, just as mine has sort of been a setup, to use the language of John Wellwood, who is the particular spiritual psychologist who came up with the term spiritual bypassing. Mm. Wellwood is, is a deep psychologist, deep Western psychologist and student of Buddhism, who really wanted us to think about how we come to these challenges that the Buddhists call, marks of suffering and marks of existence, right? The suffering around wanting things to be permanent that are inevitably impermanent, right? All of the ways that we create our own suffering and including those that are tied to identity. His teachings, as far as I've read them, help us to see that we are, again, speaking on the social and the relative plane of existence that is not fully comprehensive of our absolute being and nature. But on that social plane, again, we're embodied in certain ways. We have cultural histories and genders and lineages and stories, particular stories. And we're set up in a certain way to see things and to be understanding about certain things and to be blind and unaware about others. It's just we can't, I don't know fully what it's like to be a kind of a, let's say, a a male, cisgendered male growing up in Durban, South Africa, who feels that he's actually maybe transitioning to trans. I don't know what that is exactly mm-hmm. all about. But so having some humility about the fact that our particular positionality and the particular embodiments that we each carry actually does set us each up for knowing and really having some felt experience of certain things and really not knowing about other things is really, really important. And I think that's where having, again, a kind of humility, which is a difficult term for those of us who have felt a life of disadvantage and disrespect. Mm-hmm. So it's like we've been humiliated. And so when someone comes along and says, but you should also have humility when you engage with other people about this, can be difficult for us to kind of understand and hear. But I think that on the path of development, we heal from our humiliations, right? Even those of us who have been on that disadvantaged end of the kind of poles, if you will, of privilege and suffering that are arrayed around identity. You know, so if we're women of color and we've lived a life of poverty or we've been abused, we know that we have our own healing to do, and that can mm-hmm. be, you know, the center of our spiritual work. But as we heal, to know that when we meet others in the world, let's say they're white male who appears to be very privileged, we don't know that person's full experience. We have to have humility if we are to engage in a fully human and spiritually informed level with that person. And we can only hope that others will engage with us in that way too. So mm-hmm. it takes certainly a certain amount of patience, but it is, it also is, I think, an area where we must seek to develop our capacity to have, you know, the ability to hold all of these different dimensions of truth and to work on our own issues, even while we honor and respect that other people might be works in progress too. So we're trying to meet people where they are with compassion for the fact that we're all struggling in some way. Our struggles are not the same, but we are all struggling. And to bring love and compassion to that is, I think, the core of the work. I think it's the core of the work. And so it's to say, no, we're not going to bypass. We're going to bring insight, right? So I use the term color insight as a shorthand for describing, and it's not just about race, but it's the insight, the sort of using the from the tradition of the Vipassana and, you know, so the tradition of those Buddhist teachers who ground us in a capacity for calm awareness that can over time or maybe in some instances happen somewhat episodically and suddenly, but we develop some insight into the true nature of reality. And I think that same kind of developmental path can happen around understanding how injustice arrays around identity. That is to be in calm engagement, to sit with what does it mean to be racialized in this way? What does it mean mm-hmm. to be gendered in this way? And then to develop some insights about how these identities might be showing up in our lives right now, might be prefiguring some of us for understanding, some of us for feeling alienated, might be making some of us more vulnerable and some of us more protected, even now, even in this space, even in this setting, even in this group. That's what I mean by sort of color insight, and I do see it as a way of walking the path that is about knowing suffering, knowing that there are causes of suffering, and that there's a, you know, way of to be released from that suffering through practice. It's bringing all of that to bear on those particular issues of our lives.
Wonderful. So I'm going to go to the first question that I have here. Kozo, you are up. You should be live, Kozo.
Hi, it's Kozo from Cupertino, and I want to thank all three of you for all that you are doing in this in the world of law, which, you know, mm-hmm. for me is a difficult other. but I have an observation. I have a question, and they're not necessarily related, but they might be. My first observation is that all three of you who are doing really powerful work with compassion and law are women. And just that observation right there, you know, that it, that there's this gender force, I call it, and a gender lack on the other side. Mm-hmm. My question has to do with, you know, in terms of spiritual paths, like I find surrender to be one of the most powerful and important aspects of a spiritual journey. Mm-hmm. And I think about, you know, I think about Gandhi and I think about Nelson Mandela. They were both lawyers, right? And they both were adept in the law rooms, but in their quest, both spiritually and politically, they surrendered deeply. They stopped doing the argument, and they surrendered to ahimsa, or they surrendered to nonviolence, or they surrendered to, you know, Nelson Mandela surrendered to prison. But so I'm wondering how Rhonda, how you see that working within the framework of law, where you know, surrender is such an important part of the spiritual journey, but it's so antithetical to the to law, to arguing and to the courtroom, you know, like you rarely see a lawyer say, you know, I surrender, you know, I'm gonna take one for the team. So that just arose while you guys were talking. But once again, thank you all three for all the work you are doing.
Wow. Thank you, Kozo, so much. I appreciate your observation about the gender force in this conversation. I do think there's something to be reflected on about that as well, and put that aside for the moment. But surrender as a dimension of this. You know, I think that's such a really interesting question. And for me, it's really invites a reflection on what we mean by surrender and the different ways it shows up in places and times. You know, when I look at the lives of Gandhi and Mandela and King, you know, who wasn't a lawyer, but you know, wanted to seek a PhD in philosophy, ended up doing divinity partly because he didn't get into the program of philosophy. But, you know, philosophy is about, often can be about arguing a particular point. So all three very interested in these kinds of ways of being in the world that were about engaging systems intellectually and arguing with them. And yet, their life paths did go through, right, deep surrender as a dimension of their practice and their social change work. So for me, you know, I think one doesn't have to relinquish the role of lawyer to be engaged with surrender. In fact, I think if you are trying to do social justice work at all today, whether in law or not, given the circumstances of, and you know, the nature of the challenges, you know, we're inevitably having to surrender a lot as we go, and choosing when to pause and be patient and surrender for now, as I would put it, which is a way that I see, you know, these models of surrender that you mentioned. I mean, they kind of shifted the terms of the debate. I don't think they relinquished debate, right? You know, I think of King from the Birmingham jail writing that letter and saying, you know, to say the Christian ministers out there who don't understand why we need civil disobedience. You know, this was just saying these laws are profoundly unjust. And this is how we're going to fight them. Not that we're not going to fight them, but we're going to fight them in a different way. So it's, I think that, yeah, I think how we surrender is a really interesting and profound question, but to not necessarily be caught up in a sense of it's either surrender or it's fight. I think it's It's much more, to me, nuanced than that. And there's a certain kind of spirited fight that goes with the kind of surrender that these models embodied. And there's a certain kind of surrendered engagement that the best lawyers, I think, who are fighting, who are staying in the system, are in it. Like, I think, you know, those of us like Sujatha embodying and working in the spaces of trying to change the system to bring in restorative justice, it's staying in the system, you know, and speaking the language of it and going to Harvard and Yale law schools, you know, the center of the power, right, of the legal universe, and saying, even here, we need to talk about restorative justice. I mean, that is a way of, you know, sort of taking the energy of surrender, but not, you know, leaving the arena. And I think that's what we're asking of ourselves.
It makes me think of some of the death penalty lawyers. Thank you, Kozo, for your question, that really are able to somehow hold both truths, that everything they do matters and everything in the universe is operating the way it's going to operate. So it was just really feeling that. So I have a series of questions here for you, Rhonda, that have come in from the web that I'm going to read, some questions and comments as we're getting close to time. Thank you so much for your question, Kozo. Yeah. The first one is from Ebony, who says, thank you all for having and sharing this conversation. Can Ms. McGee give an example of a specific activity besides critical evaluation and conversation that illustrates her approach to teaching law with compassion? Rephrase, can she give an example that compares her teaching approach and the traditional approach to the same law issue? So that's one. I'm going to read them both, actually, and then they're a little bit connected, and then I'll let you do them both here. And so one is from Amit, who says, note to Rhonda. Rhonda, first, I want to say thank you for being the person you are and using your life to be an agent of change, not just for others, but for also focusing on yourself. I think that that is the part that many people, myself included at times, sometimes forget, that if we really want to make a change in the world, we have to start with ourselves. And to see you do this on both fronts is inspiring, and I wish I could jump through the phone and give you a big, big hug.
Yay! Thank you. Love that. Taking that hug in.
Yeah, she's taking Amit's hug. Then also, I have two questions for you. What skillful means do you use when you engage in this type of dialogue, especially with other lawyers, when the conversation is so often at the level of intellect and sometimes ego, and to move it down to the heart level? And question two, how do we make the personal and societal awareness and mindfulness more a part of the legal mainstream conversation, whether it is at the law school level or, as you say, or say your AmLaw 200 law firms or legal publications like the Scots blog or Above the Law? So the three I would say then are just, what's the specifics around your teaching approach versus the traditional teaching approach? And then how do we bring it to the heart level? And thirdly, you know, there's very specific questions about AmLaw 200 firms and things of that nature.
So thank you all for these questions, Ebony and Amit, and for the hugs and appreciations. And I send that right back to you, because I'm sure we're all on this call in doing this, you know, trying to engage in ways that are making a difference. And I honor everything that everybody who's taking the time to be on the call is contributing already as well. So to speak to the question of specific examples of what I do with teaching, you know, so what I've done, because I'm now, you know, 18, 19 years into this at my particular law school, and having, you know, succeeded on the terms of my institution, you know, this is how we do this work in institutional settings. We don't go in with a sledgehammer. We have to go in and sort of look around and figure out what it is that they're asking of us and what are these terms, how can we meet them. But once we do that, I've found that it gives you a little bit of leeway to start to change the terms. So what I've been able to do is introduce these practices as a kind of pedagogy for social transformation that I can bring into my law school classes. So in each of them in different ways, whether it's a personal injury law class or a class on race in American legal history, or, and then, of course, my contemplative lawyering, which is like a mindfulness and law class, I can bring these practices in explicitly, more or less. So let's take the race law class, where I have a lot of kind of content that's sort of traditional case law content on the one hand, and then make this effort ongoingly at the same time to bring in these practices. So what I do is I've gotten permission to give myself and my students more space as we do this work. So whereas traditionally in a law school class, you are racing through tens of cases a week, right? Those of you who've been in law school know the pace of and the scope of coverage is so broad and so intense that it doesn't leave a lot of time and space for the kinds of reflective inquiries that I have brought to bear in this contemplative pedagogy, married with the kind of intellectual structural work that they need and the substantive work that needs to be conveyed. If I didn't sort of go to my dean and say, well, I'm going to need more time, I'm going to need permission to cut out some of the coverage to give more time in reflection and pausing and in deep conversation and deep listening and working on ourselves in this classroom space. If I can't do that, we're not going to learn in a deeper way. And I went to my dean and asked for that and got that. So this particular class that I now teach, right? And I wasn't able to do that at first, but I was able to do that, am able to do that now. And so I say that as an encouragement to those of you who are working with other institutional spaces where you can see some changes that might want to be made. Again, patience, right? I couldn't do this in year one, but I certainly am doing it in year 18. And it is so what I do is I kind of, you know, have curated and selected particular important cases that help speak to, convey legal substance around the development of the equal protection jurisprudence, for example, or the development of the discovery doctrine by which we justify taking the land of this country away from Native Americans. So pulling those particular cases out, right, immigration cases, important ones that would help demonstrate the way immigration law has been a vehicle for racialization and oppression in this country, identifying a number, but then realizing if I'm going to do this in my contemplative way, instead of teaching 40 cases a semester, we're going to teach 14. And then allowing time and space to sort of read and do the analysis and pull out the substantive dimensions of thinking like a lawyer and analyzing in the traditional ways. But then bringing in meditation, which I bring into my classes. So we sit together. We do everything from personal meditation practice commitments, right? I invite them to practice in class and out of class. I give them support for that online and in class. And we do sort of sitting meditation. We do compassion practices like loving kindness meditation. I introduce this to them by explaining the way that research has confirmed that these practices actually have been shown, at least in some degree, to help us deal with bias and to deal with the challenges of conversations on these topics. So they come into these classroom settings now ready to learn on all these dimensions. They now are starting to, I'm sort of helping reconceive of what it means to study law, embedding the notion that you study it substantively. You have a role in this. You look at your own life as it is intersecting, as your life history has perhaps taught you something about this substance, and you work on your emotional kind of reactivity and, you know, your place in all of this as we engage with each other around what justice might look like, informed by the study. That's how I do it. So it's taking the traditional think like a lawyer approach, slowing it down enough so that we can infuse it with spiritual practice. What I don't call spiritual, by the way, in the class, I call mindfulness, I call awareness, because I'm in an institutional setting where I need to use that secular language. But it is a kind of a way of embedding every dimension of what we've talked about into and marrying it with this sort of intellectual work. And that is an example of how I do that. And in terms of just bringing this into, sort of law settings, they are surprisingly reaching out more and more to people like me to come and offer presentations. It's a challenge to bring it in to a kind of a continuing legal education model, which is like an hour and a half where you come in to the law firm, you offer maybe some sitting and you offer some comments and Q&A, and then you go away and you wonder, has this had any impact? But more and more firms are asking for that. More and more people from those firms are coming to retreats for lawyers. And as I said before, often they are motivated by the desire to deal in a utilitarian way with stress or with conflict that's arising, intercultural or racial or gendered, social identity-based conflict that's happening in their firms. So they have been calling me to come and offer presentations and workshops that feel, frankly, a bit too one-off. But I do it because I think the introduction to these principles of applying an inner dimension to law practice is itself an invitation that might lead to deepening work. And if I can open the door and support people by saying, and here's how you can follow up, I'm willing to do that work as a service.
Thank you so much, Rhonda. Amazing, wonderful answers to these questions. And we are coming to the end of our time together. If I could just ask you just really briefly, as we're coming up on the hour, to say maybe one brief idea about how it is that we can, as a larger service-based community, support your work.
Thank you so much. You know, the message I've been carrying really is about how each of us has a role to play in helping advance understanding and compassion around the many ways that social identity bias in particular causes suffering in the world. And so I would just invite everyone on the call, everyone in the service-based community to, I mean, I assume that many already are doing this, but I invite us all into a deep kind of communion around and commitment toward seeing our spiritual work as the very place where we actually work on and help others work with social identity-based bias and suffering, because you know, that kind of suffering is happening pervasively in our world and in our midst. And I personally believe that the insights and tools of spiritual work are beautifully capable of helping support liberation that begins with ourselves as individuals, but actually has an interpersonal and a systemic dimension as well. So
wonderful.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing.
So we're going to have one, I would say, less than a minute of silence, and then I'm going to open up the line so we can all say a collective thank you to Rhonda. So I will cue us at that time. So let's just go into a moment of silence together. So at the count of three, let's all say thank you, Rhonda. One, two, three. Thank you, Rhonda.
Thank you.
Loving kindness and metta to each of you.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.